At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Have you ever listened to the pod and thought it would be awesome if Jen stopped being nerdy about movies for 60 seconds and talked about your business instead? Well, my friends, you're in luck. Watch with Jen is looking for sponsors. Do you own or run a theater, bookstore, film fest, website, school, physical media firm, pod, streaming channel, or small business that might like to advertise on Watch with Jen? Whether you're interested in sponsoring one episode or several, please reach out. You can get a hold of me at contact@filmintuition.com. Thanks so much. Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Well, it is a pleasure to welcome one of my longtime Twitter faves to the podcast. Katie Stebbins is a knowledgeable cinephile, academic librarian, and the author of truly creative film zines. And for the uninitiated, that zines as in magazines or literary journals, styled books filled with collage and writing on films within a given calendar year, described as a personal, passionate, and unique way to engage with film and create a scrapbook that reflects the full experience of doing a deep dive into a year of film. These ingenious zines give Katie the chance to explore not only her favorite movies, but make new discoveries as well, which is so cool. So Katie, thank you so much for being here. How are you doing? And how is your summer going so far?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well. Summer is chugging along. Usually it's sort of, even though the students are away, when I'm at work, it is still a very, very busy time. So it's a lot of, you know, prepping for the upcoming school year and getting a lot of initiatives off the ground. And so work is definitely very busy, but I am very much enjoying the summer so far. How is your summer going?
It's going well. I was in LA for a couple weeks, which was really nice. Now I'm back in Phoenix, where it's like bordering on 118 or so in the car when you start the car and you see that and you're like, well, oh, why did I leave LA? But, you know, that's Phoenix for you, but I'm dealing. So you are an academic librarian, which I love librarians. I think that's awesome. Is it for a like K through 12? Is it university?
It is a university. Yeah. I work in Worcester. It's a pretty unique university. It's very research oriented, but it also has, there's a lot of things that it's doing. So there's a lot of needs to be met, a lot of sort of different types of resources that we use. It's, you know, very psychology and geography heavy. There's a lot of programs. It's a very wide-ranging sort of university, a lot of liberal arts stuff. So a lot of needs being met, but it's really rewarding to work in that environment and to try to sort of, you know, help the students and the faculty and the staff sort of get what they need and to sort of help contribute to that sort of campus community. And there's a lot to do, but it's very rewarding.
That is cool. And it keeps you on your toes with that many different, topics to explore and you'd be always learning. Like why we both love movies, I think, because, you know, you learn something new, you get exposed to a different part of life that you wouldn't normally. We're not like chasing serial killers or climbing aboard the tops of trains or anything in real life, but you can do that and we can travel and, learn that kind of thing. So yeah. I love the idea behind your zines and how you really go headfirst into a year, kind of blends your background with academia and being a librarian and history. So talk to me about that. Like, when did it start and the years you've done and how people can buy these?
Yeah. So how it started, it's funny. I haven't actually, the last couple of years, I haven't been working on any individual year. I've sort of been going back to years that I had done before I started doing the zines and reinterpreting that experience into them. So it's sort of, so a lot of that sort of work had already been done, which is very good, because it takes a long time. But I started it around 2013, and this was before the actual zines. I kind of just wanted, like, you know, you end up, there's so much to watch and you're just like, you end up wasting a lot of time trying to figure things out and like settle on anything. It's it's
overwhelming.
It's overwhelming. So the idea was sort of, I love a project. So the idea was to create structure around my viewing habits, and to choose a year, sort of go through decades, choose a year and do some sort of deep dive and rewatch some stuff, discover some stuff and try to pick years that like seemed less interesting on, I mean, there's no non-interesting.
That's a good idea.
Like, so when I started with the 30s and I was like, no way in hell I'm doing 1939. Like, absolutely not. Yeah. Like,
that's the most famous year.
Like, everyone talks about. So it was more about looking at what I'd seen, what I had been meaning to see, and trying to pick something that, I think also because every year in film is so overwhelming that if I'm picking a year that looks less interesting, then maybe it becomes more manageable, because I once I start something like that, it just kind of grows and grows. And I knew that that was going to be a danger.
So, like 39 or 99, you would just be there for 10 years.
I'd be there for 10 years. Yeah. Exactly. And there's, it's never going to end. Like, there's, you know, there's still stuff from the years I've done that I just like find out about, you know, obviously, cause you're not going to watch every single thing. And even if you wanted, that's just not possible, but like, it's, you're still always learning about stuff that came out during the years that you sort of, you know, explored. Yeah. So I started with like 1935, and that was like, I watched like 20 movies, and then it very quickly like ballooned into, I was, you know, coming up with like, it was like 150 movies.
Wow. I remember seeing your lists when you would post them.
And, I tried to,
it was always
more
inspiring,
organization.
But like,
trying to kind of do things thematically, and, you know, create little fun double features or like mini marathons for myself. And I started doing the zines because I had, you know, it was all kind of happening in like, you know, my blog, and I wanted to do something a little bit more, like, I felt that those were creative, but I wanted to do something that was a bit more tactile, that involved different types of creativity. And that was something that I could sort of hold in my hands, because
something tangible.
Something that I could make like from it. And that's sort of where that came from. And it's the zine format really embraces imperfection. So I felt that that was like, that's part of the appeal. So I think really like allows a lot of, you know, I guess just room to make mistakes, room to sort of grow within that in a way that felt more manageable or more like, appealing to me, I guess, and more within like my, what I found to be my own abilities, since it had been so long since I tried to tap into that. So I've done,
it's
about
good. To like, you know, use different parts of your brain a little bit. And I love that.
Like, how can I kind of represent the things that appealed to me about this year in a visual way? And it started with like me trying to tap into more of my drawing, which like, I can't draw. I'm not good at it.
You're better like, than me. Anyone is better
I really
than me,
tried,
but you're
like,
better than me.
I really, really tried. So the first couple are like, you know, really trying to hone into that. And then once I hit upon, collage, that's where I'm good. That's where I can like, I find that fulfilling. I think that the stuff that I make, you know, from that is like, is what I want it to be. And that once I sort of figured that out, it was fully in on that, in that direction. And so each one sort of becomes a bit more fully formed of what I'm looking for than the last, which is also a fun experience.
Very cool. And if people want to check these out or order them, how do they do that?
Yeah. So they're all available on Etsy. The name of the shop is called Femina Ridens. It's Femina Ridens. It's based off of a 1969 film that I really, really love. And the latest one, I released it about 2 months ago, I want to say, and it covers the films of 1930. Yeah, so that's the last one I've done, but I've also done 1990, 1982, 1965, 1958, 1943, and 1969, which is no longer available because it was the first one I did. I hate how it came out and I want to redo it someday.
Okay.
Yeah. So that one is no more, but the other ones are all available.
Collector edition, you guys, if you have that. Yeah. There you go. No, that is so cool. And I think part of the appeal to, well, I love having people on who are passionate and very knowledgeable and love movies and also smart women. So I was very excited. But I think part of the appeal of having you on is your creativity and the fact that you are always challenging yourself with these viewing adventures that you go on that are thematic. And so I knew you would come up with something special, and boy did you ever. So we are talking about that 90s early aught era of TV adaptations, and I know it came from a Letterboxd list that you were kind of compiling. I will link to so people listening can check it out where this is posted. But talk to me about this era and what led to this idea.
I love the format of your podcast because there's just so, oh my God, it's just like, where do I start? Like, there's so many different options. What do you, it becomes overwhelming to think of a topic that you want to tackle. And I was like sort of toying around with the idea of films about professional wrestling because I really fell in love with that sort of sports performance art form like 3 years ago. And I thought that would be fun. But then I was looking through old little letterbox lists back when I would actually sort of make them like 6 years ago. And I came across the one that I had made that sort of had to do with the era I grew up in and how it was just a glut of, TV adaptations specifically from the 70s and 60s, mostly. And it, I'm always interested in like film trends. I think that they can make films that maybe on the surface aren't very interesting, interesting once you're looking at it through that lens.
Yes. Yeah. At the time, it's like, what's going on? But then later,
And, TV adaptations aren't like new at all, and mining sort of successful works that you can then readapt is also not new at all. But specifically in the 90s, it was a very particular type of thing that was going on into the aughts for sure. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm a 90s kid, like that is what I grew up with. So I just thought it would be really interesting to explore that. I do think that like, I feel like Dragnet and like The Untouchables are kind of two really early ones that.
That's what I was going to say. Like what kind of launched it? Probably The Untouchables, maybe.
I think of those two as being sort of big ones, but like, and The Untouchables made so much money and like also had so much critical acclaim, but I don't feel like it represents what sort of that trend ended up becoming.
No.
Although there's a few like The Fugitive, and then obviously we're talking about the other De Palma entry for that Mission Impossible, but it's really, I feel like the Addams Family and the success of the Addams Family and that movie made so much money. I feel like that and the demographic that it sort of was, or the range of demographics it was aimed at, really kickstarted just a lot of those coming out throughout that decade. And it's, I didn't want to pick favorites, like necessarily favorites, although two of these movies are like two favorites, but I wanted to make sure it was more about the range, something that represented the range of approaches to adapting these TV shows. So that's kind of what the selection tries to represent.
For sure. And it's kind of a celebration of nostalgia. And you have like the boomers finally having kids and then being able to bring them into the theater and like make movies that, oh, you know, the old days or remembering that and being able to share with your children. I think that was part of the appeal too. They also just, I think the immediacy, like as soon as you're in this world, and the fact that it does bring back all of these memories, like Adam's Family is going to be Adam's Family no matter what it is. It might remind you of watching that. Mission Impossible, all you have to do is hear that theme song, you know it. Charlie's Angels, same thing. And so I do think, you know, that nostalgia is a hell of a drug, and this was the era for it. But I think you chose, or we chose together, kind of a good quartet, or actually five movies from this era, that a quartet of good ones, and then one we hadn't seen before that we tried. You know, we tried, you guys.
We tried.
And
we
that's
tried.
Why it was like kind of, I didn't really want to include it. But yeah, so a quartet of good ones, and then a bonus option, because, you know, we want to represent the era. These weren't all great movies. I think two of the worst, I didn't really walk out of movies too much. I remember once, like, we saw a film that was like too offensive, and which is rare because my parents are very liberal. My dad was like, no, we're going. And so we walked out of True Lies when we were, yeah, he just all of a sudden regretted, like, this is, you know, like too many speeches about girls, and it was just bad. And so we were like, no, we're bailing. So we left that. But one I did walk out, and it was after I worked in a movie theater, and I saw it at the theater that I had worked at. And so, like, when we walked out, they said, do you want your money back? And I said, oh, no, it's fine. And they said, oh, everyone is demanding, like, nobody is lasting. And it was the redo of The Avengers with Uma Thurman.
Oh, I also saw that in theaters. I almost picked it. I almost picked it because I'm like, so I knew it was bad. And, like, that's one that... It's still bad. Like, you watch it, it's still just as bad as you remember, maybe worse.
I didn't make it through. I think my brother and I just bailed after we saw, like, teddy bears. There was a
scene. I was going to ask, did you make it to the teddy bears?
That was it for us. We were like, okay, we're out. We kind of, like, you know, raise up when you're on a roller coaster, like, nope, we're done. And so we left. But the other one that was really bad, I was going to ask if you had seen it, was Car 54, Where Are You? Did you
see I've that? Never seen Car 54, but I know it's supposed to be like a real dud, and
it might be the worst of the worst. So, you know, we're talking about Dudley Do Right later. Dudley Do Right is it, you can at least get through that film. Mm-hmm. These two were like, whoa. I did make it through Car 54. We needed our ride, so we stayed there the whole time. But yeah, so I do remember seeing a couple bad ones. But then, you know, some of these were great. And I still love watching Charlie's Angels and Mission Impossible mm-hmm. and Untouchables. And I have vivid memories of seeing the Addams Family movies as a kid. So do you remember some big films that you either loved or hated from this era, just as an overview before we dive in?
Yeah, let me get up the list. I mean, one that I can think of right off the top of my head was that I saw the Lost in Space movie in a drive-in, and it is so bad. It's long. It is a long, and I don't remember what it was paired with. That movie is absolutely terrible. And that was the same year as The Avengers. There's a lot of bad ones. Like, for sure, I definitely saw Inspector Gadget in theaters. I know that that's not like 60s or 70s, but I kind of group it a little bit with that very, like,
it's that was Matthew Broderick and Julie Fisher, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember liking the cast, but it just was not good. No.
It's like 70 minutes too, which is also similar to, like, which, you know, if it's a pre-code, that's great. If it's, one of these is probably not a good sign. I'm trying to think of other ones that I definitely saw. The Flintstones in theaters.
That was my favorite.
Oh my God. It's, I don't even know what it's really, it's
interesting. Yes.
It's interesting.
We both picked that word at the same time. We're just going to go with interesting. Yeah.
We're just going to go with interesting. You know, I owned a lot of these on tape, you know, and would I like, George of the Jungle, I did definitely see, like, I owned it. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I remember liking it, which
is
interesting because it's the same director as Dudley Do-Right. And
I know, it's Brendan Fraser. Yeah.
Brendan Fraser. They're like doing the Jay Ward adaptations, and like, it's, yeah. They're, and you know, for the early aughts ones, I mean, there's just so many cartoons that they adapted, which is so interesting. And I would have, you know, if I'd been going with favorites, I would have chosen Josie and the Pussycats, which I saw in theaters.
Yeah, that still was one of my favorite
films. And, you know, I think that that one is a really, really, really great and fun sort of satire of that era and music industry and culture. And it's sort of a similar approach that the Brady Bunch movies kind of, it's within that vein of approach. But MI2 I saw in theaters. I did not see the original Mission Impossible in theaters, but I did see Mission Impossible 2 in theaters. So a lot of theater experiences, a lot of sort of things I owned on tape. And, you know, the Addams Family was a huge one for me. I was obsessed with them growing up. I went to school in braids, like day after day, tried to like have arms crossed, walk, like tried to like inhabit Wednesday, like as a life choice for like a few months when I was like,
she was your style icon. Yeah,
for sure. So that, you know, those films were really, really huge to me as a child, and are ones that I still love dearly. So, but you know, not all of them, hit that level of quality or approach. There's just a lot of weird sort of star vehicles that don't.
Or cash grabs that you can just tell were thrown together quickly and cheaply, and you know, didn't really take the time, even though it was an arduous experience. Addams Family for me, the original. I actually prefer Addams Family Values Addams Family.
Yeah.
But so the plot of the first one is kind of, it's not as good, but it's the production design, it's the cast, you know, the music, just the whole thing. We don't make movies like this anymore. No. I mean, and it was really hard on the actors. Angelica Houston has talked extensively about what they did with her eyes and how she had to like change the way she turned and walked and all of that. She earned a Golden Globe, very deservedly, or Golden Globe nomination for Morticia. And just how, you know, doomed the production was. There were so many things going wrong, people getting sick. Raul Julia had like a blood vessel burst. There was all kinds of stuff happening. But whatever, you know, weird alchemy, it made magic. It made like 7 times the amount of money that it cost, something like that, or it made back that much money. It was a huge hit. I remember seeing that in the theater, and also just how well it played to an audience. I mean, people were really invested. And I think, you know, Christina Ricci, and she was in another one in this era with Casper. You know, she was a great find as an adult. And even as a kid, I think I was drawn right to Raul Julia and Angelica Houston. But, you know, we knew Christopher Lloyd from the Back to the Future movies. And so this one was a lot of fun. It's Barry Sonnenfeld, his feature directorial debut, former cinematographer. You have a lot of the people who worked on like the Tim Burton movies who are involved in this, and it looks very Tim Burton-y. You know, it was rewritten by people who had worked on Tim Burton movies, and I think that kind of carries over. It isn't Beetlejuice, it isn't Edward Scissorhands, but you can kind of see it's the child of that, essentially, and that aesthetic. So this is a really fun one. Do you remember seeing it for the first time?
I don't. I just know that I must have been like 3 or 4 when this came out.
Yes.
So I was actually taken to the theater for it, but by the time Values came out, I definitely saw in theaters.
Yeah.
And this, you know, was, I watched it constantly, both of them, growing up. I believe my mother cut out, like, I don't know if she like screwed with the actual VHS or if we had it recorded off of like a channel or something, but she cut out the gore scene with the play that Wednesday and Huxley
There is shocking stuff.
It's
like
crazy.
Yeah. And even I rewatched Addams Family Values for this because I had so much fun watching the original. And there's a scene like right early on where a baby is dropped from, you know, the top of the building. And like,
Ralph Julia trying to see opens, which
yes, is a bowling ball, I think, or the baby. And it's like, you know, I don't know that some of, or they start everything on fire at the camp, you know,
it's
place. I don't think this would all happen this way again. I mean, we were taking risks.
Yeah. No, definitely not. I mean, like, Values really, like, ratchets up, like, approach. Like, the Paul Rudnick screenplay is so cutting and, like, so, like, sardonic. And, you know, I feel like it sort of takes what they built with the first one and really, like, elevates it to an even more special place. And, I mean, Values, I know that movie by heart. I have seen it probably hundreds of times.
Joan Cusack was amazing in that movie. Oh my God. Steals the entire film.
She steals the entire film. And it's really hard. Like, this whole cast
is they're all great.
Pitch perfect. I think that certain sequels like can just feel like retreads of the first one, especially something that's sort of mega successful, like Home Alone 2 is literally Home Alone, but like in New York, and it's like the beats are it's too much. But like with Values, it really, you know, there are a lot of similarities in the sense that they're both centered around Fester. They're both about con artists trying to grift this family.
Yes. and they did kind of go back to that. Well, yes,
they do, but like, it feels like such, like, it, both of them feel like their own thing. It really does. It's building off of that. Addams Family, like, it just was a constant. And it's one that, like, when you watch it as an adult, I find that I have even more appreciation for it. And it's not just like a sort of nostalgic comfort fave. Like, I really do like think that what they did with that film is like incredible. Like, I was obsessed with the house, and I understand why, because you feel like the production design is so like intricate, so detailed. And like, even with the way that they talk in the house, you can feel the acoustics of the space. You feel, you know, there's so much interaction with the house. Like, the house is such a focal point, and the way that all the characters interact with it, there's these vaguely supernatural elements with the house, like these books that come to life, and like just the room of chains that you pull, and like, you get to see kind of where like maybe three or four of them go. But like, as a kid, your imagination is just like, what else is in this house? And it just creates such a sense of that space. And it really like ignites the imagination as a kid and as an adult. And, you know, and the casting is just insane. Like, my God.
I love what you were saying too. I'm going to jump in real quick. When you're talking about the house, it isn't that flat CG feeling at all. And you made a really good point. You're like, you know, you can hear the acoustics, just like the chains. As soon as you said that, it came right back to my head. Like, you know, just hearing that, or the creaks in the floor. And I mean, all of these things are added and stuff, but it also just feels extremely authentic. And when you go through room, you can imagine actually they go through these rooms. I mean, it is real, kind of like the Brady Bunch house we're going to talk about.
Yeah, totally.
You know, today it would just be like four actors against a green screen, essentially.
Yeah, and there's such an attention to detail within, like, I guess, having interactions across different spaces in the house, too. Like, when Fester's yelling in bed and, like, other people hear him, or, like, when Gomez is having, like, a meltdown, because he's always, he has a meltdown in both movies, and it's amazing. Yep. But when he's having a meltdown, he's playing with the train station, or with the sort of model train set that he has. And like, you have Morticia Wednesday and Pugsley in one of their bedrooms, and like, they hear him and they know what that means. And like, they also know the sounds of the train set enough to know like what parts of the train set that, you know, it's going under. And that's, there's an intimacy with the house and with the characters, and the
realism a little bit. Totally. Yeah.
Really, it's really intimate, and it feels lived in, and I just appreciate that so much. It's something that is not, definitely not a given that movies are gonna
It's like in your own house when the door opens and there's multiple people who live there and you can just hear a footstep and you know, oh, that's my mom or oh, that's my brother. Like you can hear that sound. And so it does feel like this is a family. And I jumped in before and I know you were going to talk more about the casting, but I mean, the casting in this is incredible.
Insane. Yeah. Like Raul Julia is just like,
oh my God, I love him. Yeah.
He's just, there's just nobody. There's just nobody like him. I, you know, his Gomez is super manic. He's super sentimental. He's super gullible and naive. Like he's such an interesting character. And he's a lot like, you know, Tully, like the character played by Dan Hedaya, like, you know, he's a scumbag, but like he goes to the house and like immediately is basically forced to be in this sword fight that like is kind of real and like it's stressful.
It's intense.
And, like I get it, Tully. Like Gomez is a lot. He's a lot of energy. He's a lot of work. It's, you know, and Raul Julia just brings all of that to life. Like him and Morticia just have such an erotic, like
it's
beautiful, passionate relationship. They get so much mileage out of that together. And Christopher Lloyd, like, genuinely freaks me out in this movie. Like,
oh God,
I find him very unsettling, like, more than any of his, you know, I know people talk about Judge Doom a lot, and like, he's really a creepy, and Dennis the Menace is like a, creepy. In that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the first Addams Family specifically, like, way less so in the sequel, like, I still, I'm just completely terrified by him. There's the when they open the door when they're having the seance and like the smoke is coming off of him. The score really supports the performance too. It everything feels very just unsettling and wrong.
This movie did scare kids. This was around the time this was like 91, so I would have been about 10. And then when it came out on video, like I was babysitting and I do remember parents like renting it and like, oh yeah, just show our kids. And some of the kids were really scared of it. And then, you know, then I was reading a bunch of stories after we were watching some Disney stuff because it's scary for little kids.
It's scary. And I don't think that like it's obviously like a film aimed, I mean, it's aimed at both adults and kids, but like not in a way that is sort of flattens everything out. It actually, now, and what
it
we definitely,
plays,
you know,
multi-generationally.
It's trying to do there's just a, you know, a lot, and there's a lot of stuff in there for adults, not necessarily in like an adult humor kind of way, but just that you don't see it being designed for kids.
Toy Story or something where different parts of the audience are laughing at different things. And
there's something like none of the tone of this movie feels like it's for kids.
Not at all.
There just happens to be a couple of kids in it. Like that's what sort of feels like. And yet, part of that is why it just feels like, you know, the approach of that is just not how, things are approached now, even though I do think that like at that time there was so much conversation around that same idea that we complain about now, which is just sort of everything being flattened to sort of service all these different demographics at once. But like when you watch that, you're like, but these things were still able to get made that are really idiosyncratic and very like fully formed. You know, and I also like I cannot remember who does the score to this, but like, I do feel like this is sort of exists in the age of, I feel like the 90s are like the golden age of like blockbuster or just like sort of big budget mainstream scores. Mm-hmm. Like, I just feel like, and we'll get to it with Mission Impossible too. Like the score of this, it all creates this like sort of sense of the world in a way that feels very particular. Like, I don't think that anything else really feels like these two movies. Whether, you know, whatever people get out of it, you know, is going to differ, but I feel like they just have a very specific feeling to them, and the score really, really helps that a lot. I really adore this movie still.
Yeah. Looks like Mark Shaiman was the composer. I also said the soundtrack produced by Hummy Mann and Mark Shaiman. So I think the score was great. This was also the era where we had like you know, a rap version.
Oh, yeah.
Because we have an Addams Family rap situation going on with MC Hammer. So it was a couple, maybe just 1 year, actually, 1990. And then, I don't know, when Secret of the Ooze came out, but the Turtles, they had the Vanilla Ice. Yeah. So this was definitely that time period. And I think Addams Family Values came out same year as, or right around the time of like The Fugitive, I think around that same year. So we were getting some, you know, Hollywood was getting some bang for their buck on these movies and just kind of went all in, as they like to do. And some were really good, some were creative, and some were not. But I think it was good too, what you were pointing out about all the creativity and all of the kids and just the cast, because when I was doing some reading about it, it said something like Barry Sonnenfeld credits Christina Ricci actually for a plot point with at the end of the movie, Fester was going to, it was like, should he be an imposter or should he not? And Ricci was so adamant, like, no, he should be the real guy. And it went against what Sonnenfeld's first instinct was. And he said, so she made this passionate declaration of why he should be part of the family and the real guy, that they changed it. And then by the time they got to Addams Family Values, he realized, oh my God, she was so right. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So this was a really fun one. I was glad to revisit. I had not seen these movies in decades, so this was a good opportunity. And then the film chronologically after that would be the Brady Bunch movie, which was 95. I remember seeing this one in the theater. This was directed by Betty Thomas. I love the fact that when it starts, you do feel like you're watching, like, where did this come from? Is this a long lost episode? Because it does feel so, Michelle Long looks so much like Florence Henderson at first. And I really love Gary Cole. I think he's good at playing drama and just so good at playing comedy. So they make a really good duo, Carol and Mike Brady. The cast with the kids is good. I think this one gets a little too weird and a little, it goes a little too out there for me. I remember seeing the sequel, but same thing. I saw it was on Pluto, so I started it this morning. I'm not finished. It was bringing back, like, I'm pretty sure I saw it. I think it's a little more creative in the sequel, but I'm not sure. I haven't finished the movie, so I'm sure I'll you can tell me that. But you remember seeing this one in the movie?
Again, I don't remember when I saw
Brady. Yeah, but
this
you
is
do.
Another one. I definitely saw this when I was a kid, and it's another one where I think the sequel is better, and I think that the sequel takes what they do in the first one and like really like elevates it a bit. I still like, I do really enjoy this movie. I think that like the gimmick of it is so, like the high concept sort of gimmick is so, I don't know, there's something about it that they never kind of show their hand. Like, they commit to it so wholeheartedly that
it's almost like you can imagine the Barbie movie kind of getting that idea a little bit. For those who don't remember what we're talking about in this one, the Brady Bunch, it opens, you think we're watching this family in the 70s because we are so entrenched in it, and then when we get outside the house and we're driving car, we realize it is modern day 1995 and they're just still living like that. And so it does have this sort of Truman Show-y kind of thing going on.
It exists as if like they were ripped out of their sitcom. Like, almost not even ripped out of it, just like sort of transported into 90s LA grunge like times. And it's very much about that, but like they seem incapable of understanding the world they actually live in. It's so interesting. Like, it never, you never get, like, anytime anyone's talking to them about like, about the sort of disconnect that they have, like, it's like they can't process it and they don't hear it, and they just live in this sort of 70s sitcom artificiality where like they're all laughing at Alice's terrible jokes, and like they're all of the bits that they do sort of repeat, and it feels in that way almost like it, like a John Waters type of approach, like
a PG-13
John Waters kind of, you know, film. It's very satirical. There's like it the whole all of the humor is based out of that disconnect. Like that's where like the characters themselves are just not, it's a sort of fish out of water family, but they don't seem to ever recognize kind of their actual world is. It really just does commit to that. There is just no realization ever, or even a flash or a moment in which they seem to acknowledge that there is a difference between who they are and like what their life is, and like that they're living in a different era.
I know. And I like that, you know, it could have been really easy just to make them a punchline because of that, but they are still genuinely like a family who cares about each other. And so that is a really difficult, tricky line to walk, essentially, you know, when you have that going on. I do remember seeing like Siskel and Ebert around the time, and Ebert kind of having a problem, and he thought they should have gone actually further in the outside world, because he said the Brady Bunch is like very PG and the movie's PG-13, but he almost thought it maybe for the John Waters-y kind of feel of it, that if they went even further, if they dialed it up more, it would have been funnier. But I think it's tricky because you still want to appeal to families and kids. And so I think what you were saying is right, how they kind of figured out what worked really well about this in the first movie, and then kind of, you know, went to bat with it in the second one, just like we were talking about with Addams Family. And that usually happens in television anyway. The pilot sometimes is radically different than the show that develops. Like the beginning of Halt and Catch Fire feels like Mad Men or something, and then it finds its own footing, and Buffy is different, Veronica Mars, these shows kind of go into their own. And so for these movies, they figure out what works, kind of like this would be season two or the second film. Yeah.
And I think that like, it's sort of, you know, I appreciate it again, like that sort of commitment to what it's doing. Cause I do think that it can be alienating in a way. Like it's definitely, you know, the whole point of it is that it's mimicking that pace, that sort of static quality to such a degree. And like that each character kind of has their one bit that repeats, like, and
Cindy is the tattler, and
you know, Greg's talking about far out chicks, and like that, it's he's like,
and Jan is jealous of
Jan's
Marcia.
Like hearing voices, and you kind of get like, Mike has the life lessons that sort of just go in circles, and everyone's and like, yes, we've heard all this, Alice has terrible, like, everything she's making in every scene is just looks atrocious, and like, so there's a, you know, it, I think that the mileage does run out because you do sort of get that repetition, which I think is what,
like, kind of
improves a bit. But it's really committed to like things feeling awkward and stilted and static, and like it's and that's where the humor is. And I think that I just appreciate that it does lean into that, where like it's not, you know, they're going to set this up and then they're going to go somewhere. No, they set it up and then they kind of just stay there, which I think maybe, you know, which I think kind of works against it in a way too.
A little bit. Yeah,
it does. But I also just appreciate that they
went for it,
that they just went for it. And I do think it led to a sequel that does build on that in a way that is a bit more satisfying.
I love Jean Smart. I will say,
oh my God,
like, it's kind of in the mode of like Joan Cusack in Addams Family Values, sort of this sex pot. She's coming on to all of the Bradys essentially. And just, I mean, I love Jean Smart anyway, but if you're a fan of her, you're going to really want to give this one another watch. Again, hadn't seen this since the 90s. So this was fun.
Yeah, it's really fun. And it is so like, all of the sort of stuff it's referencing with it, the era that it's made in, is just makes it that much more of a time capsule. Like, it's weird. It's like, there's just so much in Sweetie. We're like, oh my God. Like, there's like one line where one of the guys is just like, she's harder to get into than a Pearl Jam concert. And you're like, yep, here we are. It's this era. I just, that
and your RuPaul.
Oh, you got RuPaul. Yeah, you got RuPaul doing a cameo. It is. It feels very 90s, and that's sort of what the whole thing operates in. Where, like, you know, at the time, like, it's trying to kind of comment on the era in which it's current, but now looking at it, it's like the time capsule of that 90s piece of it is like sort of adds this other layer of kind of like fascination with sort of the way it's trying to capture that time, which feels so removed from where we are now that that's sort of its own layer, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And then right after that, this was 95. We have a series that's still going on, of course, Mission Impossible 96. I remember seeing this. Actually, it was the day school got out that year. My brother, it was his last day of high school. So he was super excited. We just went right from school to the theater. It was a sellout. Like, everyone had the best time. I cannot like hear the phrase red light without finishing that, or the way she says that. One of my favorite reactions to this movie, and we are talking, Mission Impossible, the De Palma, the original here, is Denzel Washington. In the 90s, of course, you remember there was like the, you know, ET or Entertainment Tonight, and they would show these clips where they would just ask celebrities dumb questions. And one of them was on a red carpet event for something. Someone asked Denzel, like, have you seen Mission Impossible? And he just like answered and decided to be completely honest and just said, yes, I did. Am I stupid or was that hard to understand? And to this day, like, oh, if there's incredible. A plot that's like too convoluted, I will just say that. And because it is like, that was actually the big criticism of the time. Like, how many times are we going to say knock list? There's too many times where people are ripping masks off each other and like, wait a minute, he's bad, he's good, he's good, he's bad. Like, it was a little, it took me a couple viewings, I will say, to like fully iron out all of the, okay, she's playing him or he's playing her. And, but you don't really care when you're watching.
You don't really care. Yeah.
It's so much fun. The action set pieces, I mean, De Palma famously will like invent those. Like, well, we're going to break into the CIA and we're going to do it from the top. Like, you know, these ridiculous things. We got to do something on a train. You know, it's very De Palma that way. You got a million split diopters. You have just all kinds of craziness. I love the audacity of killing off like two
stars
right away. Like,
it's nuts. Every time I'm like, you know,
you're like, it's Emilio and Kristen Scott Thomas. Has
Mighty Ducks, he's gone. Like, what's going on?
Yes, it's like, oh, it's Emilio Estevez. 2 minutes later, he's dead. And then, oh, the beautiful woman from Four Weddings and a Funeral, she's dead. And then for a little bit anyway, you're like, John Voight, he's dead. And you're like, what the hell is going on? And, you know, so it's very gutsy there. You establish Ving Rhames, Luther, which, you know, the 90s was a little bit tricky for Ving Rhames after Pulp Fiction. So it was good that he kind of got to move away from the crime style of films or the darker films. Jean Reno is good. I think it's a great one. I think this might be like Untouchables, like two of the best for sure. And Fugitive. Yeah.
Yeah, oh my God, I love this movie. Like, I love it so much. No matter how many times I see it, it's the same, just like all in, like every time, all in. It's just such a ride. And it's one that I saw maybe when I was like 10 or 11. And it's one I've seen many, many times since. And it's, you know, it's got this weird tension of being like a Brian De Palma movie, but also is a Tom Cruise vehicle.
Oh, yeah.
This is what he is launching his production company with. Like, he is, there's Cruise so much
Wagner.
At stake for him. So there's just like this, you know, very, very, two very, very strong voices that both come through really beautifully. You know, but you can imagine that they're coming at it from different sort of points of view.
Oh, you also have like David Koepp and Robert Towne and all of these people involved behind the scenes. And you're like, how did they all work together? Well, allegedly, sometimes not very good, but whatever worked. I mean,
whatever worked. It comes across as a movie that like, where it feels very assured. It feels very like this is what they were, you know, came together to make. But when you read about the production history, you're like, oh my God, there's so many iterations this went through. They started without like a complete script. Like no one knew like what, you know, they had so many different people working on the screenplay.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything.
And it's just so much of it is just like calibrated at such a high level. Like, you know, you have De Palma, who's like he's always cooking, but like he's really, really cooking here. Like it's the spy genre fits him so well because you've got the roving cameras, you've got all the overhead shots. He loves all the surveillance type of
the cloak and daggery moments,
screens, and it's very playful in that way that things are with the double crosses and like the paranoia, everything's always folding in on itself. It's self-reflexive. Like all that stuff is like,
it's super horny. Too.
It's super exactly.
Like you know,
it really is.
The later Mission movies are kind of sexless, but like you start with this one, you're like, whoa. Yeah. You forget. Yeah,
and you know, I always, whenever I watch it, I'm always like, oh, whoa. I always forget how, you know, I always feel like the movie is a lot more with the aspect ratio that it's a lot more widescreen than it actually is. But it's because De Palma is just using every ounce of the frames to like the left to right artistry happening. There's so much going on, the Dutch angles.
Oh my God. You've got
like so much crazy lens work happening. And this is like one of the most beautiful, like looking sort of blockbuster movies of the decade. Like it's the filmmaking is so immaculate and so endlessly like rewarding. I think about like the fish tank restaurant scene.
Yes.
Just amazing. Which like Tom Cruise was like, build this restaurant for me that we can explode and like just crazy. Like so you've got this scene, you know, with Tom Cruise and the other guy who is still in the franchise.
He was Kittredge. Yes.
Kittredge. Yes, Kittredge. And they're talking and, you know, it's like we go with the A, B, we're going back and forth. And then he doesn't even build up to it. He just cuts in on this extreme close-up of Cruise. We are underneath his face. The lighting's crazy. He's dead center. And it's so extreme. And like, he doesn't build to it at all. He just sort of establishes that pattern. And then once you kind of realize what's going on in the scene, he just completely rushes you with this other sort of dynamic. You're going to feel it in the filmmaking to such a degree that, you know, it's very cutting. And there's a lot of that type of stuff, like with the canted angles and the close-ups and the way that like things are happening in one part of the frame and the frames are sort of lit differently in different parts of it so that everything feels so expansive. And in that way where it's very much about watching and being watched and sort of spy work in general. And it's so, so compelling and it's so entertaining, but not in a way that like, it's trying to be like a fun movie, quote unquote, but it is that it takes itself seriously, but in that way where you can kind of just let go and go on this ride with these creative people that put something together that is just so entertaining. The Langley scene is rightly, you know, so iconic.
Amazing.
I mean, Charlie's Angels ends up doing sort of a take on that later, because it just became like a recognizable scene. And you know, you've got this crazy score by Danny Elfman that is just so. It's I find this movie kind of unnerving as well. There's something about the tone of it in parts that I is almost uncomfortable in a way for me.
Like, there's a lot of dissonance. Yeah.
Visual,
audio.
Audio. Yeah. There's something really slinky and slippery about it. Mm-hmm. And the score really helps with that. And definitely like when you start with sort of that entire team getting decimated, it's when you're seeing it as a kid, it's very like, I mean, I will never forget Emilio Estevez in the elevator. Like it is
I know.
Like so messed up.
You almost forget every time you watch, you're like, oh yay, it's Emilio. No, well, bye.
You know, and it's also De Palma, like just completely playing with us like playing with everybody. And he's like, he feels like such a puppet master all the time. Like I'm convinced, you know, it feels like in the Langley scene when like Jean Reno is like in the vents that like he himself put the rat in the vents instead of like the rat just being there.
I love how the payoff isn't what you expect. We expect we're going to see the rat like climb over him, and we're going to, and then like in a moment you just see, oh, it's a dead now. It's just a dead rat. Okay. It's you know, it's going against expectations so many different ways. So yeah, it's super intelligent. Yes. It also is so 90s in the sense that it ends with the cranberries. I mean, there's the cranberries and dreams like right before the ending. There must have been a law around like the mid 90s where every movie had to use that song essentially. And I'm a huge Cranberries fan. I saw them in concert, you know, in that time period.
That's awesome.
But it's like it was in everything. And it's like, oh, it's even in Mission Impossible. So,
yeah. And it's not like that, like, this is a movie that, like, the Danny Elfman score is in it every, like, from beginning to end. And then all of a sudden it's the Cranberries. And you're like, oh. Okay, like, I'm into this because it's Cranberries, but it's, you're just like, in case you didn't remember that this was the 90s, we're going to cap it off with, like, Luther and Ethan talking that, like, a cafe with this song playing in the background. It's so sweet.
I know. And then it sets off, like, we're going to have another one. We put him back on the plane and, you know, the Cinema of the Caribbean, or I can't remember the exact thing at the end.
Yeah, that's it. But, that's the one.
But I love it so much. This is a really good one. I watch this film a lot, and I can watch it again. Like, right now, talking about it, I'm like, when are we watching?
I'm ready. I'm ready. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm always up for it.
Yeah.
It's still my favorite in this franchise. I love this. I do love this franchise a lot.
Oh, I love the franchise.
First one is my favorite.
I also love that they're all so different. I mean, once you get into the Macquarie era, they get a little, but even he is like, the new one is kind of nuts. And, but they're all nuts in very weird ways. Like, you know, we're just going to have PSH like zap people in the head. And then, you know what, we're going to redo Notorious. And, but you know, it's really interesting how they did that. My favorite is Ghost Protocol, because I love the whole beginning with Ain't That Amazing. A Kick in the Head and all of that stuff. But this is probably right there. So there's so many good ones in this franchise.
There are.
I don't think there's a bad film in the bunch, really.
No, I mean, I really don't like three. I've come to not like three, but I'm still like, I don't skip it. Like, anytime there's a new one coming out, like, we will just do, like, my partner and I will just, we'll do the whole, it's just an excuse to do all of them again. And it's always just a great time. I love that it's still going, and, you know, that they're still, you know, I guess it's sort of very, very old hat to have like these callbacks to like something in all of these, you know, all of these sort of continuing franchises and reboots. But the ones in Mission Impossible feel so satisfying. You know, when you have Max's daughter sort of showing up as a character, and Kittredge coming back, and like Dead Reckoning and stuff. I think there's a lot to be said about, as much as I love the Macquarie movies, I do think there's a lot to be said about the way that it does move from this very kind of like auteur driven sort of franchise into this sort of more homogenous, still very entertaining, but like, and doing its own thing, but much more sort of level playing field than much more cohesive as a franchise once it moves into that latter half. I think there's a lot going on with that sort of decision, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, Tom Cruise and that sort of control over that vision. But love these movies so much. So
I do too. And I think we're going to want to rewatch them when we get to our next one, which is not chronologically. It's Dudley Do Right. This came out in 99, which was, you know, one of the best years of film. It's up there with 39 and, you know, a bunch of them, but 2007. But we are talking about not a great picture, Dudley Do Right. It is written and directed by Hugh Wilson. You have Brendan Fraser. I really enjoyed, I will say a good thing about it, was Alfred Molina. I mean,
he's great.
Love seeing Alfred Molina.
Thank God he was in this. Like thank
it would have been unbearable, I think, without him. I don't know what was going on. It's too, there's scatological humor. It's just stupid. You don't really get what's happening. There's like a cartoon at the beginning, and then like to pad the running time, because otherwise but you know, we have very off-putting like Native American humor.
Kinds
of stuff happening. It's not a good film, so I can't imagine we'll spend too much time on it, but we had not seen this one, and we needed to. I mean, we weren't going to want to rewatch The Avengers, essentially, but.
No, I did go into this with like open arms. I really was ready to think that I'm ready. Let me think that this is sort of like, you know,
fun.
Not an unsung classic, but that, you know, it's not as bad as people think, or like just something. You know, but I did want something that was sort of universally panned. And I wanted one that was a cartoon adaptation, because there were just so many. You had Scooby-Doo, you had Flintstones, you had Casper, you had Mr. Magoo, you had Fat Albert. I mean, there were so many cartoon adaptations around. And then the other, you know, George of the Jungle, but then the other Jay Ward one that they followed this with, which was The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle, which is that mix.
I actually liked that one.
Mm-hmm. I've seen it once and I can't remember it at all. And I do want to go back to it. But
it was pretty clever. Piper Perabo, well, I thought was, I think she was game and made it so good. Yeah.
Yeah.
That one, again, I haven't seen it in forever either, but I do remember really enjoying it back then.
Yeah. And that's
Rene Russo, De Niro. Yeah.
De Niro. Yeah. And that's sort of my memory of George of the Jungle, you know, the first sort of Jay Ward adaptation. That was also a major sort of a kids film vehicle for Brendan Fraser at that time. And I remember really adoring that. And I, you know, I actually watched like after Dudley Do Right, I'm like, I need to cleanse with sort of, let me go back and watch a few of these Dudley Do Right cartoons. Cause I did grow up a bit with sort of Rocky and Bullwinkle reruns or whatever, not like a huge part of my childhood, but definitely something I was familiar with, and like the Fractured Fairy Tales and all of that, that they start the movie with. And like, the Dudley Do-Right cartoons are 4 minutes for a reason. Like, you know, and they do what they do really well in that 4 minutes. Like, it's this really fun, like, sort of almost like take on like a silent serial type thing without it actually being silent, but it's that sort of idea. You've got the sort of piano music, and you've got the good guy and the bad guy, and you've got like these just sort of very, almost like just very over the top. I don't want to say cartoonish because they're cartoons, but it is that sort of very clearly delineated sort of character, I guess, choices. You got the good guy and the bad guy and all that. But like, I do think that like the one interesting or semi-interesting kind of plot point in the movie, I thought, was like this idea of Dudley having to become the bad guy in order to sort of stop Snidely Whiplash.
Subversive.
Snidely Whiplash being like, who am I without, if I'm not the bad guy? And the second Dudley Do-Right cartoon I watched is about that, and it does it so much more brilliantly, like in four minutes. So much with that concept. And you know, Dudley Do-Right, like, it's sort of like, oh, there's something here with that, but it never, nothing ever pans out in a way. It's like the longest 77 minutes. I cannot believe this movie is so short. It felt like it would not end. And it's, I feel like it's trying to do, like, it's trying to really commit kind of like a Brady Bunch movie type of thing to like what the original format was, where the narration is constant. You know, where it's, everything feels very sort of insular to this, the world, like in terms of the town. And, you know, it doesn't, you know, Dudley's just sort of stupid. Nell's just sort of like, I'm interested in both these guys. Alfred Molina is like basically Jack Lemmon in The Great Race.
Yes. You know, that's a very good pull. Yes.
Yeah. And he, so it's trying to do that. It's also kind of trying to do sort of like a Zucker type of humor thing, I feel like, but everything feels so disconnected. It doesn't feel like there's any, it's just like things cobbled together. There's no
cohesion,
no cohesion. And no, it's like no one really thought like, why is this funny? What's funny about this?
Yeah. Everyone also seems to be in different levels of performance. Like, Alfred Molina is clearly in on the joke. Eric Idle, I mean, it's a little, you know, cringy, but he kind of gets what he's doing. You know, Brendan Fraser is playing Dudley Do-Right, and he kind of commits. I do feel bad for Sarah Jessica Parker, because her character just feels like an afterthought.
Really,
and
weird.
She gets to dance, and she gets to, you know, I'm hoping it was good payday for her. But overall, you're like, you just wasted someone who's so amazing in like Honeymoon in Vegas and all these other films. And you're like, what are you guys doing? Yeah.
Yeah. There's like, when she first comes back, you know, and you can see she's kind of in that mode of similar to sort of Mars Attacks, her work in Mars Attacks, and almost like her, not her work in Ed Wood as the character, but when she's doing the performances in Ed Wood, she's like being like, you know, when she's like the angel and she's being kind of like, you know,
a little wood.
Yeah. Where it's that very, that woodenness, but like in a way that's working. And then like they, or at least it's like sort of trying to with no material to work with at all. But then she's just sort of there and she's just sort of like, I think I like Alfred Molina. And then like, it's just very
strange.
You can
tell she just had no idea what, no idea what she was doing in that movie.
No.
And I don't think a lot of people knew. And, you know, I think everyone was on a different page essentially. And it shows.
I think so too. I think the one thing I will say that it's one moment, one line that I loved in this movie is when Alfred Molina, because of course, like he's the only, there's just one part where he's just like, I love to lurk, it's so me. And I just like love
that
line
is so good.
I'm just like, why? This is, that's hilarious. And nothing else about this is, it's like Brendan Fraser, like they really really bank on like his likability and lovability to sort of carry you through, but like the character is so not, like there's no reason to, you just like, or just like, this guy seems like a loser. I don't like, not even a lovable loser.
It's
just
him
sort of,
in like Encino Man or Airheads mode, but not as funny as Encino Man.
Yeah, he's got like nothing to work with. So he's just sort of adrift. And it's really, it's depressing to watch. It was a depressing watch for sure.
It was. And it, you know, like you said, 77 minutes, I kept pausing it. I know it's a bad sign if all of a sudden I'm like, you know what? I got to do some dishes or like, you know,
that's never good.
That's never a good thing. If you're like, you know, I should really dust that lamp over there. Like I'm going to stop the movie for a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you're prolonging it and 77 minutes takes like 5 hours, but but you know, we're putting that one out of our mind. We're getting into another one. One that was, I think, overall pretty well received. There were some critics who didn't like it, didn't get in on the joke. I think they might have been burned out too by this point, where we'd had so many bad TV adaptations. And we're talking about Charlie's Angels, the 2000 version. I love this movie unabashedly. The sequel is a totally different thing. It's not my favorite. I'll still watch it, of course. There's great stuff in it, but it's a lot darker and weirder. This one, it's really celebrating these three women, but it's also just the cast overall, beyond, of course, Cameron Diaz, Drew Barrymore, Lucy Liu. You have Bill Murray, Sam Rockwell, Tim Curry, Kelly Lynch. Crispin Glover is the weirdest. And
oh my God,
so great to see him.
Yes.
I will say, like, the one sour note for me is Tom Green. I think, he just kind of doesn't fit. But, you know, you watch it enough times, you're like, okay, I get the Chad. You have Luke Wilson. You know, it's great. I think this movie is just so much fun. I can't imagine. One of the critics said at the time, like, Cameron Diaz in this film looks like she's having more fun than any actor has making a movie in the longest time. And she does. I think when people saw that and then saw Being John Malkovich either that year, or was it? No, it might have been 99, around that era.
Yeah, it was right
99.
Then.
Yep. Just like seeing these two performances, it's like she, you know, people underestimated what she could do and what she can bring to a film. But it's a lot of fun. I love this one since I saw it in the theater.
I adore this movie. It's, you know, I would have been like 13 or 14 when it came out, so I was right in the theater watching it. Like I think I saw it twice. It's, I think, you know, even more than the trend of TV adaptations, it's just the most 2000 movie ever made. Like,
oh my gosh.
Oh my God. Like, it brings me back, really brings me back, in a way that I do find very satisfying. Like, it's very, like, all the wire foo, it's very post Matrix. You've got that going on.
Yeah. The bullet camera,
the bullet times thing, and just all of the wire work. You know, you've got just like the music cues, like it opens with like Korn's blind and then that comes back later. And you've got like, just, it's all of those touch points that like, you know, you grow up with that kind of just immediately transport you. You've got this like, you've immediately got the Mission Impossible mask. So there's a lot of sort of callbacks to that film. And you've got this
also just stuff from, you know, it knows it's playing to multiple audiences and different generations too, because then you have stuff from like the 80s where we have a Soul Train scene, we have a scene that looks exactly like a Kubrick thing. McGee was a huge Kubrick guy, you know. Red, we're sort of doing a Shining situation, but also 2001. But you have, you know, 80s, we have Spandau Ballet, we have DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, you have Heart, Aerosmith, Motley Crue, but then Marvin Gaye, but then you also have like Fatboy Slim and Prodigy.
And,
like, all this stuff. So I think the music's really inspired.
It's eclectic. It's a very fun, like, you've got those sort of touch points that are very much like, okay, I am like, this Korn song would never have appeared in this movie if it was made like 2 years before, or like even 2 years after, but like, it, you've got those very like hyper specific sort of era pieces to it. But yeah, it's drawing from so much. It also has like, it feels very much like a girl power era type of movie. Like, that's the kind of thing that it's drawing from. It's, you know, it very much leans into the cheesiness and the kitsch of the original show. There are times where like, it almost feels like it could be almost like a big budget, like Andy Sedaris movie, where you're just like, is this going to go into the sleaze territory? But then, no, that's not what this is. But there are some of the dialogue scenes that just feel like it's that self-aware kind of like, you know, beautiful women sort of like having fun and being playful and being sexy.
Yes. I signed the waiver. You can just feel free to stick things in my slot.
Yep. All of that stuff is in there. Like, they're in on it, but like, it's very much leaning into that, the sexuality, like with them all the time.
And also using it, which is funny.
Yes.
I think like one of the most hilarious sequences is Cameron Diaz's character is pretty clueless. She's adorable, but when she meets the Luke Wilson character, she doesn't really know exactly how to flirt or what she should do. Like, my favorite comeback is when he goes, "I'll get tickets. I love tickets," which is great. Yes. But they tell her to flip her hair, and there's a line like, "Lucy Liu, flip your goddamn hair." And but also they're using the sexuality, which is funny. But I think that there's a lot going on in this movie. I also, I love it made people really fall in love with Sam Rockwell, which I had done, you know, in some of the indie movies in the 90s. So it was good. It's kind of Drew giving some of her friends some work, which is cool, and seeking out. I know there was some stuff with Bill Murray and some tension on the set, unfortunately. But you know, I think I didn't really get into the new one, unfortunately. Elizabeth Banks, I thought it was, you know, a good try. Kristen Stewart was good, and even though she's like, I don't know what that movie was or what I was doing in it, you know, she was at least good in those moments. I think the other cast members were good, but it just didn't have that same appeal, that zaniness. You know, and it's also very aware of what it's doing. The opening sequence, it feels very self-referential, like you were saying, like on the plane they're gonna have TJ Hooker the movie, and they make a joke about all these, you know, TV shows being movies. What are you gonna do? You're gonna walk out. There's also a character with Lucy Liu's boyfriend Matt LeBlanc, where he is an actor, and so sets are being moved and pieces. Like, there's a scene where you think she gets shot. He's like declaring love, and you realize he's just on set, and you know, she's fine for a minute anyway. And so there's like a lot of playfulness to this that I think really works.
Yeah, it's super playful in a way that is really, you know, I from the point of view of like 2024, a specific kind of refreshing, because I do miss this approach. Like, I really do. You know, I think that I have not seen the 2017 Charlie's Angels, but I feel like from like the trailer and everything, it's just, you know, that is a really good sort of juxtaposition of kind of how these sort of reboots and stuff are approached a lot of the time. And, you know, it's, there's that opening scene, like I watching this movie, I really was just like, this is the most MTV Movie Awards movie to ever
exist. It really
is.
Yeah.
Like that feels like it, that LL Cool J cameo and like just that entire scene feels like the opening skit of like mm-hmm. one of the MTV Movie Awards. And like, I, you know, yes, there's all of that kind of playful stuff that does feel like it has references to things that if you were growing up or like, you know, young at the time, that sort of ties back
like
to that.
Like Tim Curry over my dead body. Yeah, great. Because if you're a Clue fan, you just like want to jump up and down. Yeah,
exactly. Like there's just like a lot of stuff like that. But like the general that tongue-in-cheek approach and just the vibrancy of the movie. And also I really feel like, I mean, there's so many montages, there's so many costumes, there's so many like sort of
very elaborate. Yeah.
Very elaborate and very very, very fun. Like it really felt like they approached this in a way that was like, what do we want to see these stars doing? What kind of fun scenarios do we want to see these, like what kind of
race car,
you know, wacky spy and stuff and like and like the race cars, there's so much mileage that it gets out of the appeal of seeing them in different outfits and different disguises and different like it, you know, and in a very kid-like way, but like it's just very, very fun, like very playful, very fun. It moves quick and there's so much you see them doing, and the bubbliness of it is between the three and just the three of them in general. It feels like they are having so much fun.
And wonderful fight choreography.
Wonderful. I love the fight. The stuff with the scene with all the stuff at the end is great, but like that early scene with the thin man with the Christopher character in the alleyway is so good.
There's a chain link fence. There's all kinds of stuff.
It's great.
Yeah.
And if you're, you know, at that time, like, you know, it's The Matrix and it's those other Hollywood films that are using kind of wire work that are what get you in. Like, you know, I was not seeing the sort of Hong Kong films and like these sort of kung fu movies that mm-hmm. are using that from the past. So like, that's really the introduction that I had to like that kind of style of action choreography and action shooting. And it's great. And then you're like, well, where did this come from? And then it brings you into this whole other world of like martial arts movies. But like it's Drew Barrymore and Cameron Diaz and Lucy Liu doing like, you know, wire stuff and flipping around that gets that sort of opens that gateway for you. And I, you know, I really love that. I love how much of an influence that ended up being for a short period of time on action films of that era, because it's so fun.
It is. And just like with Mission Impossible, you have the wattage of a star making decisions. You know, Drew Barrymore was definitely a driving force behind this movie. And, you know, I think it also just bodes well, like you said, about how they get along. I mean, they still to this day, they're tight. I think, you know, it's just they were all in it. They were doing all of the training. I miss the era of DVD extras.
I
remember that this one had some really good stuff showing how they developed the style of fighting for each woman based on their strengths. Like, you know, Cameron's legs could do this and Lucy Liu was good with precision and kind of fluid movements and Drew was kind of the brawler. And they figured out exactly what to do. And so that was really cool. Also, the production design. I mean, this is an expensive looking movie.
It is. Again, it looks expensive.
It is. And we're moving from set to set to set. And it's different than, you know, I'm sure there was, you know, CG and stuff. But it's not if all CG. It feels very tactile. And, you know, it's cool to see which location we're going to be at next. And like we have a Dr. No situation. You know, we have a Hollywood Hills shootout and there's all kinds of good stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, there really is. And yeah, it's like with the sort of expense of the film, like with all of those scenarios they come up with, that you end up, a lot of them, like you see them for a flash and you're like, oh, that was a whole place they went to. That was a whole setup that they did. Like these are, that's something that they used for like maybe 5 to 10 seconds. And you're like, wait, what was that all about? And you never see it again. You're like, there's a lot of that in this movie. And they really, really do try to like create as many different situations, even the ones that we're not really seeing, but just things that show you how much they do together and how many fun, wacky sort of things they get into. And I will say that, like, in my mind, from when I had seen, you know, I hadn't seen this in full in like quite a while, but I thought that like the Drew Barrymore, Sam Rockwell relationship was like, had a lot more time. Like, I really remember as a kid feeling the betrayal of that. Yeah. And then when I watch it as an adult, I'm like, oh, they like knew each other for 2 days. They slept together. They maybe had one conversation on screen. Yeah. Like, oh, there's not much that was going on here.
I know. Well, they were
so interesting.
Around this time period, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. Mm-hmm. And he was definitely betraying her there. But yeah, it is a quick relationship. But I love the two of them together and they make Sam dance, which is always fun.
They make Sam dance, which is like, you know, you've got all of these sort of trends of the time that it's sort of commenting on or of the past. And like the sort of Sam Rockwell dancing thing is at the time, developed.
No.
Definitely the earliest thing I'd seen him in, although he's in like other stuff but as a kid, that was the first sort of my introduction to him, I think. But, you know, obviously the Sam Rockwell dancing sort of scene has become like very like familiar and very much like something you can count on. And at the time, like this was sort of the, you know, I don't know if it was the first, but it's definitely kind of a very early version of something that would become a trend, like with his sort of career, which is interesting. I've actually not seen the sequel. I've not seen it. I am going to watch it. You know, after we finished the first one, I'm like, I'm up for what, like, I don't care if I like this or if I don't like it. Like, I'm so up for like whatever they made together in this sort of franchise, because I just adored the first one so much. And you're just sort of ready for more of that. Like, it's just such a fun environment to sort of be in.
There's a lot to it I think you'll enjoy. But it's darker. It kind of, there's like a Cape Fear plot with Justin Theroux. So that'll definitely fascinate. There's, you know, they kind of go a little too far in places with the, hey, we have to be sexy and distracting. Like we're riding a mechanical bull. We're doing a flash dance thing. Like they take it a little further in the sequel. It gets a little nuts, especially the Justin Theroux, like, I don't know what idea they had with that, but gets into dark territory, but it's still watchable. But it's definitely, I prefer, the original on this, but I'm eager to hear what your thoughts would be, but
I'm excited. Is it also McG, the sequel, or
let me see. Good question.
Yeah. I cannot remember if it was the one doing that.
Throttle.
I do feel like that style of his is like just really integral to what that movie ends up feeling like.
It is McG.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
That's exciting. I do. Cause I feel like that, like he really thrives within what the framework of like that sort of is. And that's sort of, that's what I want to watch him doing. Cause like those are sort of where his strengths are. So I'm excited to check out the sequel.
Yeah. Well, before I let you go, are there any other films that you want to make sure you give a shout out to if people are listening and want to check out some other good ones that were made?
Let's see. I mean, I do think
touched on some.
Yeah. I mean, definitely like, the ones that we didn't really talk about like in depth, but definitely touched on like Adam Sandler Values and like the Very Brady sequel. Like those are just two movies that I really, really adore.
Yeah.
And you know, I had mentioned Josie and the Pussycats. That's one of my favorite movies ever. I have been so happy to see it get this resurgence. Because I was like in that theater, I'd watched it and I'm like, what the hell are people talking about? This was awesome. It remained a favorite all throughout my life. And now people have embraced it. So I'm very grateful for that. But those are like the sort of main ones. There's just a lot of duds. Like it's a lot of duds. You know, I am curious to revisit a couple of these. I do want to rewatch Wild Wild West because I saw it when it came out and it is Barry Sonnenfeld. So I'm just intrigued. I don't know what I'll think of it.
But I don't remember that one very much either.
Yeah. I feel like the sort of mechanical set kind of, I'm sure there's a better way to describe what that movie looks like, but just the production design of it, I feel like I would at least appreciate a lot more now that that type of
That's gone away.
Quality is again just like not something you can count on really. But those are really the main ones. I really feel like, I mean, The Fugitive is great. Obviously, and I feel like Mission Impossible and like The Untouchables and the Addams Families are really like the sort of other high points. But it's a lot of filler. It's a lot of McHale's Navy. Penelope Spheeris's The Little Rascals, even though it's not it's much more of like a harkening back to an earlier time. I do really adore that.
I do remember, I think Sergeant Bilko was kind of funny.
Yeah, I've actually not seen that one.
But again, I'm going from memory from way back. Magoo is not.
It's really bad.
I was going to say, because you love Josie and the Pod, Josie and the Pussycats, I was going to ask if you'd heard my friend Blake Howard's show, Josie and the Podcats. He made this show with Maria Lewis, his best friend, and it actually won some awards in Australia. They interviewed everyone like associated that they could, Rachel Lee Cook, everyone, and did like an audio history of the show and then the movie and the adaptation. So I would recommend anyone listening, if you're a fan, check out Josie and the Podcats. It's one of those by Blake Howard, so it's under One Heat Minute Productions, wherever
that
you
sounds amazing podcasts. I will definitely check that out. That sounds awesome.
Wonderful. Well, Katie, I want to thank you so much for doing this. We might have to do like a wrestling episode or anything else you want to do next time.
I would love to come back. Yeah, there's just so
much.
There's with free reign, there's just so much. I'm really excited to. I don't think that you've recorded it yet, but the rodeo movies.
That's coming up.
Because I mean, immediately just think of The Lusty Man, and that is just one of my favorite movies ever.
Oh my gosh, me too.
I am definitely, I love that as a theme. So I'm very excited to hear that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.